Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's cool fact of the day is that mycoestrogens are kryptonite for your testosterone, just like xenoestrogens found in plastics and personal care products. Fungi and mold from foods like produce can make these estrogens, and they can be found in the environment around you because of water damage in houses, which is why I made a documentary called Moldy about it. But the biggest source of these estrogens is actually corn, wheat, rice, barley, and sorghum. So these can be thousands of times more potent estrogens than what your body would naturally make if you turned your testosterone into estrogen. So if you're like me right now, walking around with a bigger than normal case of man boobs, I actually spent a night in a moldy hotel room and woke up the next morning with some interesting swelling. So that'll go away in a couple of days. But I don't know if you can see, but I'm looking, you know, somewhat muscular, but I'm a little bouncier than I ought to be. This is an issue I've always had because I grew up fat in a basement. Anyway, you don't want mold in your mold or estrogen in your environment, and particularly not the combination of the two.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
By the way, today's guest may completely disagree with me, and he knows a thing or two about this kind of stuff. I have no idea what his perspective is. Pretty well-known guy. His name is John Romaniello. Now, John, I just realized something. We've hung out a few times, and
yes, sir.
I always just called you Romaniello, but there's an I in there that I never noticed. Have I been saying your name wrong this entire time?
I'm
just
being
like a dick.
No, we don't use the I. The I is it's a silent I. I assume many generations back it was Romaniello, but we're particularly Americanized, and we just say Romaniello.
Romaniello, yeah, okay. That's what I've always said, and I just I noticed the eye. I'm like, my God, like it'd be kind of embarrassing. People call me ass spray all the time, so like I'm pretty resistant to that.
No, it's that eye has plagued me since elementary school. For whatever reason, my teachers would always take it and throw it at the end of the name, and it would become Romanelli, which is not my name. So it's very strange. But yeah, the I has caused all sorts of trouble.
Are you Italian?
I am what we call miscegenous. I am quite racially mixed. I am probably more Italian than anything else, but I'm not as Italian as my name implies. My birth name is Giovanni Vincenzo Romanello III for no good reason, except like now it's tradition. But and this is just of interest if you like history. Oh, but yeah. my father's mother is a beautiful woman named Willie Ellen Barrow, and she was from Buckaloo County, Alabama. She was half black, a quarter Irish, and a quarter Native American, and then she married my grandfather, who was like Italian and Polish. And so I think I present to most people as like a Guinea from Long Island, but I'm actually this like mixed race guy with Southern roots. So
it's mixed with some redneck in there too. Wow, I'm impressed. Oh, yeah. I'm not quite redneck, but I'm from New Mexico, so like, you know, we're sort of
redneck.
Like kissing cousins, right? We don't have enough water to be real rednecks, and you know, we make tequila, not moonshine, but otherwise.
Otherwise, it's the same.
Well, for people who don't know your name, you're a fitness expert, pretty well known. I keep coming across your stuff, so when I finally met you, I was like, oh, this is really cool. John, you write for Men's Health and Fast Company. Mm-hmm. You're an angel investor, advisor to a bunch of fitness and tech companies, and your company, Roman Fitness Systems, is one of the top-rated sources for online information, particularly around like exercise and fitness, and you're sort of a walking wall of muscle, but not a balloon animal, so you've got that thing down about right.
Thanks.
And where I think most people have seen your name is because you wrote Engineering the Alpha, which is a book that I've definitely talked about before. I've seen some really good information in the book. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that introduction.
Let's talk a little bit about hormones. This is going to be a short episode for people today. Tell me about how men produce estrogen. I kind of opened up with my story about my man boobs, but tell me what's going on with estrogen because you've really looked into this.
Yeah, so obviously, like the hormone that we talk about most with regard to men is testosterone, right? And I think that there's probably this misconception that that more is better, and I think that there's a point where that's true, but obviously there's a line of diminishing returns. But with regard to estrogen, you know, men produce it naturally, and also it gets naturally produced in our bodies, but it also gets produced in response to heightening testosterone. Yeah. And so really what I talk about is the balance, right? Because I work with a lot of professional athletes, and I have over the course of my career. And a lot of those guys use performance-enhancing drugs, and particularly testosterone derivatives. And if they're not careful, what can happen is as they inject exogenous testosterone, some of it will convert directly to estrogen through a process called aromatization. And then there can also be an increase in endogenous production of estrogen. And so really what I talk about is maintaining that balance. Like obviously it's impossible to quantify, like you want a 4-to-1 balance of testosterone to estrogen. But in general, you do want to keep natural estrogen production stable, and you don't want any of these massive spikes. You know, spikes of testosterone are typically not going to harm you in any way, whereas spikes of estrogen, as you mentioned, even some short-term environmental exposure to mold or dietary exposure to phytoestrogens, mm-hmm. like soy or sorghum or xenoestrogens or neuroplastics, that can have some acute physiological effects. In your case, you know, you had the swollen breast tissue or anything surrounding the chest. For a lot of people, it results in some sort of emotional instability. For others, it can result in sexual dysfunction. So these are things that we need to be really aware of. With regard to sex, I personally view sex drive and typical sexual function as probably the most reliable barometer of health. If you are a guy who typically has like a normal or a very high sex drive, and then you wake up one day and you're not interested, that is particularly telling that something is wrong. And then also in terms of sexual performance, if one day out of absolutely nowhere you are struggling to achieve or maintain an erection or achieve orgasm, those things are very, very telling that something could be wrong hormonally. Obviously, it could be any number of things physiologically or psychologically, but I just find that in general, if there's one thing you walk away from this podcast with, it's that for men, I think sexual function is the most reliable barometer of like general endocrinological health.
My first book was about fertility, and it involved men and women. Like, what do you do before you get pregnant and during pregnancy to have really healthy kids? one of the biggest things that tells you whether your mitochondria are working or not is whether your sperm can swim.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So I looked at that as well as if people are having fertility problems, whether it's they're men or women. But if you're a guy and your little guys can't swim, your brain can't think either, because the same thing that makes them swim makes you think. That's how you make electricity in your head.
Right.
When I was 26, so I used to weigh 300 pounds. I would already lost some of the weight by the time I was 26, but I went and I got my first full like anti-aging hormone panel. So this was going back, geez, like 17 years or something. I came out of it sort of shocked because my testosterone was very low, mm-hmm. and my estrogen levels were higher than my mom.
Goodness. Well, so, and she, at the time, I assume your mom was postmenopausal. So estrogen was like slightly suppressed relative to what it would have been during the prime of her fertile years.
Absolutely.
It's amazing. You know, I see guys who have all sorts of elevated estrogen and suppressed testosterone. And there's this sort of, drive, I think, to like, or it's like, well, how do I fix it? And, you know, for elevated estrogen, a lot of times the immediate response is aromatase inhibitors, going on clomiphene or Arimidex or Nolvidex or something like that. And those things are fine, although clomiphene is not technically an aromatase inhibitor.
Yeah.
And those drugs are great, and they work really, really well for a lot of people. But I think that in general, the first response should be to try and address those things in terms of lifestyle, diet, nutrition, and environmental factors.
And by the way, for listeners, that's pretty much what you talk about in your book, like engineering the alpha. Go through all this. So if you're a guy or you're a woman with a guy who's got man boobs or these other dysfunctions, it's worth a read. It was one of the, and I say that like as a compliment, because there's a lot of just, you know, testosterone good, eat eggs good. And it's a little more complex because of this dynamic with the environment coming in and feedback loops. And I thought you nailed it in a way that was pretty approachable.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, the book thankfully was very well received. You know, again, I think that because it was a book intended for men, you know, it is a little heavier on the testosterone than the estrogen stuff. But I think that one of the main things that we really focused on in that book, which is it's both the easiest to do and the hardest to execute, is sleep. You know, that's this massive thing. And you know, as an entrepreneur, you know, like if you get 9 hours, it's like the best day ever. And to get those 9 hours is very difficult, to carve 9 hours away. But, you know, it really is important, particularly for men with regard to testosterone production. What people don't realize is that if you sleep, well, first of all, let's establish this. After the age of 30, testosterone drops about 10% per decade in terms of natural endogenous production, right? So that's about 1% per year. So let's quantify as that 1% per year testosterone will drop after the age of 30. But regardless of age, if you sleep 6 hours per night or less for as little as 2 weeks, testosterone production can drop up to 15%. So if you think about that, it's getting 6 hours of sleep a night or less for 2 weeks, you're physiologically, endocrinologically aging your body by 15 years in terms of its ability to produce testosterone. And that is something that is, we harp on all the time. And I know that, you know, it's like people want all of these fixes and they're willing to spend money. Sleep is free is the great thing. Sleep is a free thing that you can do, you know, it's like ideally a third of your life. But it is also the hardest thing to execute, right? Because we've got all these other things going on. You know, we have stresses. A lot of people suffer from anxiety-induced insomnia, where they are actually, even when they're sleeping, their anxiety is working, their brains are working overtime, and they actually get pulled out of REM sleep because their autonomic nervous system is massively stimulated from whatever stresses are happening in their life. And that's a very, very different thing from like pure physiological insomnia, where you can just take melatonin, and as long as you can fall asleep, you'll stay asleep. And so addressing those things through other means is interesting. And also, we're very busy people, you know, I'm not going to touch on the, like, I'm not going to be your dad. I'm not going to tell you, like, don't look at your cell phone before you go to bed because the blue light is going to stick. Like, that's not what, I'm just try to get to bed earlier. Like, it's that simple. Just 15 minutes a night, you know, and just start. And you'd be surprised that you can go to bed at 10 o'clock and wake up at 6. And, you know, it's hard. I know, particularly, listen, when you're a parent, right? Dave, you have three kids now?
Two
kids, okay. And they go to bed at probably like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock.
Sometimes, yeah.
Ideally, right? You know, like my kid is 10, my son is 10 years old, and he goes to bed at like 9:30. And if I'm going to go to bed at 10, that leaves me a half hour of alone time with my wife. And that is obviously a challenge in terms of like fostering our intimacy and really like, you know, spending quality time building our relationship. So I understand that there are all of these factors in terms of things that prevent you from getting 8 or 9 hours of sleep. But it really comes down to like, what else can I cut out, you know? And a lot of times it's as simple as like, you know, maybe we're not going to watch that hour of TV that we love at night until the weekend. And instead we're just going to like go in bed and read together and talk or have sex or whatever it is. And you know, you'd be surprised how like if you and your wife go to bed a half hour earlier, like how the frequency of sex goes up. And that's
it's, you know, amazing what like laying in bed together does, right?
Yeah, it's like, well, we're here. I mean, like, what else are we gonna do? You know, we don't have a TV in the bedroom, right. So I guess. So there's all sorts of things around sleep that I think it's this really interesting thing. You know, I work with a couple of mattress companies, and I've been very fortunate to a company called IntelliBed recently sent us this unbelievable mattress, and it's really great. And you know, like what stuck out to me is that I am a health professional, and I have never spent more than $2,000 on a mattress, and even that seemed like a lot. But you know, it's like I know guys who are like, you know, they're like saving money so that they can buy that Tesla, which is a great car and an amazing thing to have. But like, I think that the recent, and this comes from Tesla directly, I think Elon put out that the average automotive owner uses their car less than 10% of the time, less than 5% for most people, right? So you own this $150,000 car that you use 5% of its lifetime, and then you spend a third of your life in bed and you're going to skimp on your mattress. So like, it's this interesting thing, like invest in your sleep, you know, your time, your energy, your money, just like make sure that you get quality sleep. And it's been this massive thing that, you know, has been hugely helpful to me, because if I can get really great sleep and my clients can get really great sleep consistently, then those high stress periods where you are working on a launch or a new book or a product or you have a new baby, like you can absorb those a little bit more easily.
Have you looked at chronotypes? Michael Bruce was just on the show, who was a sleep doctor for Dr. Oz. And just wrote a book talking about how 15% of the population is night owls, and they actually do better going to bed after 11. There's a number of people, like I think 55% of them go to bed at like with the sun, basically, and then there's the early riser crowd. I was interested in that because it seems like testosterone production, which is circadian, like it goes on a daily basis, it may shift depending on what your type is.
Chronotype is, yeah. It's interesting to talk about, and I became very interested in that because I have always classified myself as a night owl in terms of not only when I feel best, but also when I'm most productive. When I was living in New York City, I found that my best hours for writing were from around 11 p.m. till 4 a.m.
That's what I did last night. Exactly that. Right.
And the great thing was at that time, you know, I was a New York City bachelor and I could go to sleep at 4 or 5 a.m. and I could wake up at noon and it was fine. Now, obviously, you know, having a child who has a school schedule, like he has to be there at 7:30 no matter what. You know, that's just how it goes. And so I have adapted to a more traditional life of going to bed when the sun is gone. But I think that you can adapt. I think that there are certain like everything there are, you have proclivities and things that maybe you gravitate towards. But you can adapt. And it took about a year and a half, maybe 2 years for me. To be able to have the same level of production from noon to 5 p.m. as I used to from 11 to 4. But I can do it now and it's fine. It just took a while to adapt.
That's impressive. For about 2 years, I taught myself to wake up at 5 a.m. every morning and wake up and meditate and all that. And I finally realized at the end of it that I had adapted, but that it was just not natural.
Yeah.
And so it's not working for me. So I went back.
Now, how is it? Is it you wake up a little later? And
I actually go to bed at 2, and I wake up when I get during the summer. I wake up at 8:50, so I can start calls at 9. And my average amount of time in bed is 6 hours and 1 minute for the last 3 years. I didn't used to require that much sleep, and I'll wake up without an alarm clock that way. And it's not an insomnia thing. It's like I'm good to go. And that shifted by about 2 hours as I improved my mitochondrial function, as I basically got rid of stuff that wasn't working biologically for me. So I've seen some data, and this is really interesting because my testosterone was absolutely in the shit, right? So, but I wasn't following any of that advice. I find now that there's a study of 1.2 million people that found the ones who lived the longest were sleeping 6.5 hours a night. That people who slept 8 hours were they were dying more of all cause mortality, including diseases and all that, than people who slept like 6 hours. And it was really weird. And that's not to say that this is prescriptive. I think it's just that people who are abnormally high, like high performing biologically, they just require less maintenance at night because things are working.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I can do 8 hours if I really like, you know, if everything is dark and I have a mask on and I like take some supplements to like facilitate that. But in general, I'm a 4, 5, 6 hour guy.
You are too.
And I'm fine. Okay. And I function. Here's an interesting thing. I don't know that I've ever admitted this on a podcast. When I was a kid, I was a bedwetter, which is a horrible thing. Until I was like 10.
Though. Oh, wow. Okay.
It was late, right? So I was a bedwetter. And so I had some issue where I could not, when I was sleeping, realize that I had to go to the bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. So I went on what was then an experimental drug that eventually got approved by the FDA called DDAVP. And this was a drug. It was a nasal drug that you take. And after like 2 weeks, it stopped. I was able to wake up and go to the bathroom. However, I have not slept through the night since then because my bladder is so sensitive that the moment I need to use the bathroom, I wake up and I go to the bathroom. I probably get up to pee like 4 times a night, 3 times a night because I drink a lot of water. And but the interesting way that this has affected me is that I slip in and out of sleep like nothing you've ever seen. I wake up, I go to the bathroom, I hit the mattress, and I am out immediately.
Wow.
And so I've done sleep studies where like how quickly it takes me to get into REM sleep is it's like phenomenally quick. And that is really interesting because it also allows me to be very, very high performing and high functioning when I'm awake. But if I want to take a nap, I can close my eyes and fall asleep pretty much instantly and wake up without any. And I always wake up with the same amount of energy. I can get 3 hours of sleep or 8 hours of sleep, and I wake up. I'm always in the same mood. I'm always like ready to go, happy. And so, you know, I'm very confident that this will be pushed to the limit when my wife and I should we have biological children of our own, where now I've got this baby that's up at all hours. But you know, I came in as a stepfather and he was 5, so I missed all of that.
From that perspective, I did an experiment with sleep where I'm like, I'm going to get 5 hours or less every night to actually trigger obesity, and I'm going to eat like stupid amounts of calories. I was just going to do it for a month or two, and like 4,500 calories a day on average, just to like sort of prove I didn't gain as much weight as I should have from eating all this fat.
Sure.
And just because I'm curious, right? And I felt like amazing. But what I haven't really told people is that experiment started the day after the birth of my second son, because I'm not going to sleep more than 5 hours a night anyway.
No matter what. Yeah,
it's a great time for a study, right?
Sure.
Two birds with one stone. So you're absolutely right. Your sleep will be wrecked for like the first 9 months, like no matter what you do.
Yeah. Okay. And I think I'm probably better equipped to deal with it than most, but no matter what.
You it's are.
In terms of the testosterone stuff,
let's go back to that.
So I was always very, very naturally high. I got my testosterone tested for the first time when I was 22 or 23 years old, because I was a data-driven guy. And I was really into Charles Poliquin at the time, and he talked about that. So I got tested, and I was at close to 1100, like 1070. So very, very naturally high testosterone levels. And then, I was 23 and I was building a business and things were like going well. And then I hit a wall. And so I was 25 years old and I was in this relationship with this woman, and she approached me and she's like, "Hey, do you know we haven't had sex in like 2 months?" And I was like, "Oh, that's weird." And I had gained all this weight and things were just not going well for me at 25. And, eventually that relationship ended, as things do. If you don't have sex with someone for 3 months, they'll leave. And it was just like this, you know, I've detailed it elsewhere, but I got my testosterone levels checked and I was at 540, which is still reasonably high.
Yeah. But not for that age.
Not for that age. And not for my testosterone levels were like roughly half of what they had been.
Yeah. So around 1,000 in your mid 20s is a reasonable number from memory, and maybe 950.
For high testosterone guys, you know, around 1,000, most guys could be at like 7 or 8 and be fine. So I was experiencing all of these ill effects from being, you know, in the depending on when I got tested, it was like the high 400s, low 500s. But, you know, the range for testosterone, for anyone who doesn't know, is about 230 nanograms per deciliter to 1,150 nanograms per deciliter, depending on the lab you go to, right? So being at in the 500s, I was still high enough that I was in the normal range and could not get any medical treatment. And so I had to figure this out myself. And at the time, listen, I was 25 years old and I was being an idiot. It was when I first started like social. I didn't drink alcohol until I was 25.
Okay.
So I didn't like have that high school and college experience. So now I'm 25. I'm drinking on the weekends and
beer estrogen, huh?
It wasn't. I never drank beer. I never Smart. Acquired the taste. I dove right into whiskey because it like
better choice.
Something about the way like brown liquor looks in a glass. It looked really cool to me as I dove in. but I was drinking on the weekends. I was not getting a lot of sleep because I was building my business and running around chasing girls after that relationship ended. But honestly, I just wasn't taking care of myself. I was training probably 10 hours a day, training clients and wasn't making time for my workouts. My diet went to crap because I just kept eating less and less because I noticed I was getting fatter and I was trying to maintain low body fat. Eventually, I got my testosterone levels checked and it was in the 500. So now I reverse course. I start sleeping more, trying to stress out less, ate a lot more fat, made sure that like my carbohydrate intake was where it needed to be. I wasn't overindulging on carbs. It was whatever I needed to recover from workouts. But the sleep made the biggest impact. And inside of 6 weeks, my testosterone was back in the 900s. And then 6 weeks after that, it was back over 1,000. And so this became this very interesting thing to me where I realized like lifestyle really does affect this. And, you know, alcohol is probably not something that, you know, like most people are willing to cut out, but lowering it, pretty significant impact there. And I noticed that as I was on this increase, the estrogen did go up, but I had no ill effects. And then after my testosterone remained elevated for about 6 months, the estrogen levels dropped naturally. So I think there was just some, you know, like biological, feedback where it's just like, all right, testosterone goes up, estrogen needs to go up. And my testosterone has stayed very, very high since that point. However, I'm 34 now. Yeah. And I get my testosterone checked every 1 to 2 years. And so when I was 28, it was at around 1,100. And then when I was 30, it was like 900. And then when I was 31, it was like 850. And then I recently got it tested at 33 and it was like 690-ish. And that's still high, but I noticed the downward trend. And I know that I'm doing everything right in terms of lifestyle. And there was nothing else that I could do. So I made an educated decision to get on some low-dose testosterone replacement therapy.
High five, by the way. Thank you for just putting it out there. I went on it when I was 26. I went off it for several years and measured my levels, went back on when necessary. Because how did it feel when you went on there? Like what did you notice?
I mean, so I went on – this is, I guess, it was right before my 34th birthday, which was in April. So I want to say this is probably – second week of March of this year and it is now July. So it's been, you know, close to 6 months. What I noticed immediately was how much better I felt, just like overall feeling of well-being. And again, by the way, very low dose, 200 milligrams a week. It's enough to keep me back up where I was in my late 20s.
Are you injecting or cream?
Yeah, I'm injecting. Okay. Yeah. So, but I'm not in super physiological ranges. So, So the first thing, overall quality of life, recovering from workouts more quickly, generally feeling like a lot more just happier, and I sleep better, sex drive is a little higher. I did not notice anything in terms of physique or body composition until I went on a family vacation. We took Isaac to Italy for his 10th birthday, and I was gone for I guess 11 days. And so, I have a prescription, so I was able to take my stuff with me. But what I noticed is that I was eating gelato and pizza and being in Italy for, you know, an extended period of time and not really, the only gym that we could find was at a train station in Rome and so I think I got to work out 3 times in 10 days. And what I noticed is that I made the decision to under eat on calories. Because I knew my food choices weren't going to be great. So I normally was eating around 2,800 calories. So I dropped down to around 24 and I was in Italy eating pizza and gelato and not training. And I lost body fat. And, And I think that's because obviously when you're on higher levels of testosterone, you can undereat and not sacrifice lean body mass. And so for me, that was the first time I noticed anything in terms of my physique. And that was when I had been on for about 9 weeks. And then since then, I decided to let me get a little bit more dedicated with tracking my macros and training a little harder. And so my body composition has continued to improve, not drastically. I don't look like I'm about to step on stage, but I'm leaner than I would be without it. But overall, honestly, David, I for whatever reason, I had this thing in my head where I was going to wait as long as possible to go on TRT, and having now been on for several months, I'm just like, man, why did I wait so long?
It's life changing. Your zest for life comes back. Even if you didn't really not have a zest for life, it's just better. I know Mark Sisson, who's been on the show a couple times. He's older than either of us. He's in his early 60s. I'm 43, and you're basically 10 years younger than I am. I think you did the wisest thing you could do, and I would encourage everyone who's listening, who's men and women, get your hormone levels tested, even if you're 25. Even if you're 30, know your numbers. What's natural for you?
Exactly. That's the most important thing. And I tell all guys, get your levels checked, and women too. Because here's the thing. Even if you're not experiencing any ill effects right now, and that may continue, and hopefully it will for you, the important thing is that getting tested, it establishes that baseline, right? For me, had I not gotten tested when I was 22, 23 on a whim, then when I was 25, if I had gotten tested and I was in the 500s, I would have been like, I'm fine. This is not the issue. But having had that baseline from 3 years prior allowed me to see that normally I'm at 1,000 and now I'm at 500. My testosterone had dropped 50%. There's no way that couldn't have deleterious effects. So for me, I think that there's this really interesting, conversation that goes on where, everything around testosterone is steroids, and then TRT is generally a little bit more positive. But there's this middle ground where there's no good information. And I'm really trying to help fill that void. I think everyone will come to the point where they get to make that decision. And if you have the knowledge and the supervision of a doctor and the means and the will to do it. Listen, I'm not going to tell you injecting four times a week isn't a pain in the ass, a literal pain in the ass.
It is, right.
Where you're injecting. But the trade-off is fine. I mean, I feel great. I have an apartment in New York and our house here in California, and I have, a supply in both places so that no matter where I am, I can keep my level steady. And, it's made me really, really interested in experimenting with other things. And so I talked to my doctor and I'm like, oh, maybe, I've got this nagging lower back injury. And I'm like, all right, maybe if I did a 3-month course of growth hormone while I was going through aggressive treatment, muscle activation therapy and active release therapy, maybe that would really help fix the issue.
It's absolutely worth trying. I did growth hormone when I hit my head, as a way of working with TBI, and there's good data for it. And it's not an admission of weakness. It's just controlling your biology. And there's this weird puritanical thing, someone in the 70s used a derivative of testosterone and had liver problems. So now if you use it to stay young, you're somehow cheating. I'm like, okay, I'm cheating, whatever. I just want to feel this all the time.
If you're not competing, it's not cheating. So for me, I'm fine with it. But for me, one of the interesting things about having built the muscularity that I have and having the types of pictures of me that are on the internet is that for the entirety of my career, I've been accused of using steroids. And I was always very vocal. I was like, listen, I don't think anything's wrong with steroids. I have plenty of friends who use them. I'm not currently. But, and this is the most important thing, if I ever decide to start injecting shit into my body, I will tell you. And so
there you go.
And so I'm, I put it out there, and it's really interesting, Dave, that the response has been universally positive. Not
good.
One person has pushed back. It's crazy. I thought I was going to get all sorts of hate, but everyone is just because I came at it from a very objective, scientific and very honest perspective. Here's why I did it. Cause I noticed a downward trend. I didn't want that. And I'm good. And now instead of people hating, I just get all these great questions about it. And the interesting thing is that when you come out about using at 34, any question about using when you were 24 sort of goes away. And so it's almost, I thought that there might be something about it potentially damaging legacy, but it's been universally great.
What about ball shrinkage? After 5 years of testosterone, I went off of Clomid and Arimidex because I didn't appear to need them anymore, which my physician had me on, and I wasn't cycling. even though I probably should have been. And eventually I noticed that the guys were a little smaller than they should have been. What are you doing to protect yourself from that?
I'm on low-dose Clomid. Okay. I think I'm on 50 milligrams every other day.
Smart.
But I have not noticed any testicular shrinkage yet. I think it's more of a long-term thing. But again, you know, a lot of it is dose-dependent. Right. And I was talking to a friend of mine who works with a lot of bodybuilders and professional athletes, and he says, you know, everyone has different genetic responses to everything, right? There are some people like myself who are genetically predisposed to putting on a lot of muscle.
Right.
But he's like, what people don't realize is that is the same thing happens with steroids or testosterone replacement. There are people who respond like crazy to 200 milligrams. And then there are people who can be on, you know, three times that dosage and not have the same results. And so everything affects everyone a little bit differently. I feel like I am getting a lot out of the dose without any ill effects. So I'm very curious to see how that goes. But obviously the main thing is even at this dose, once you cross like the 8 to 12 week threshold, sperm production drops dramatically. So should my wife and I decide that we do want to have another child, I will need to come off for, you know, 3, 4, 5 months and allow sperm production to come back up.
You could probably turn up your Clomid and have no problem with that.
Yeah, you know what? I've thought about that, except I've just spoken to a lot of guys who say they just get like a lot of emotional like damage from Clomid, where they just find they're like very weepy, and I'm like, right now I'm good, and I'm not interested in. Not interested in like adding another like emotional like hiccup to the mix.
I hear you there. All right, next question. I know you've got another.
Yeah, no, it's good. We I got a couple minutes.
You got a couple more minutes. All right, cool. Next question is the question I've asked everyone who's been on the show, and it's if someone came up to you right now and said, "Look, given everything that you've learned in your life, what three pieces of advice would you have for me if I want to kick more ass at everything I do? Like, I just want to perform better as a human being." What matters most?
Environmental exposure is the number one thing. You know, just surround yourself with awesome people who are doing awesome things. And if you want to get stronger, hang out with strong people. If you want to make more money, hang out with people who are making more money than you. and that goes for everything. I mean, like I think environment and community are everything. Yeah. So that'd be the number one. Number two is data. You know, track as much as you can, as often as you can, without it becoming inhibitive to your enjoyment of life. For me, that means journaling. I'm a writer first before I'm anything else. So for me, it means journaling and like taking stock of the day and really trying to see, you know, like if I've grown as a person year over year. But for a lot of people, it's, you know, like tracking the quantifiable data, like testosterone levels and whatever else. But I think like keeping a record of your life is important. You know, like who knows, maybe your biographer will need those notes one day. And then the third thing, I think that, you know, you need to know what your, what your guiding pillars are. And the things that guide your decision-making processes. And I think it's worth like, you know, writing those down and also vocalizing them. And I think that, you know, so many times we get caught up and we don't know how to make the right decision, or we don't know how to make the decision that's right for us. And I think that like, if for me, if all other things are equal, just do the right thing, right? Like, I think that I don't like to talk in absolutes. There's not always a right thing and a wrong thing. Everything is shades of gray, but like usually there's one that's like less douchey. You know, there's a decision that's just like, it's going to like, and some, usually it's the harder decision, but if you can't figure out how to make the decision, then just choose the option that is going to allow you to like that if people told the story about you, you'd feel the best about it. You know, so do the right thing. Always be above board. Always go out of your way for other people. Like, exhaust every possible avenue before cutting ties, and just, you know, like leave it all on the field. For me, it's very important before I end any relationship, whether it's business or otherwise, that I'm able to walk away and knowing that no one can say I didn't try. And I think that like in business, and you know, I've always like gone out of my way to like try everything before I like shut something down, because I like to know that like I tried everything, and I like to know that when the story of my life is told, it's like the thing that will be said about me is like, he always tried to do the right thing. And that for me is huge.
That shows a lot of integrity. And I can tell you, out of more than 300 episodes, you're the first guest to ever say, choose the least douchey option. So,
well, thank you. There you go. Really
great tweet right there.
Put a little feather in the cap there.
Truly funny. Let's see. We already mentioned Engineering the Alpha, which is one of the books that I absolutely endorse. And you're working on a new book about the hero's journey and yes. kind of superheroes. And certainly there's a superhero vibe with what I do. Do you have time to talk about that?
Sure. For those who are not familiar with the work of Joseph Campbell, I highly suggest that you read a couple of his books. The most well-known of which is his seminal work, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is the introduction to his thesis of the monomyth or the hero's journey, which is a storytelling cycle that is apparent in all great stories, whether it's the messianic myth of Jesus or Krishna or Buddha, or the more recent tales of Luke Skywalker, Harry Potter, King Arthur, any of, they all follow this same 17 stage cycle. And I became introduced to Campbell in college, and it's been very, very helpful to me in terms of writing. But I believe that the hero's journey is portable and applicable to any great change we go through in our lives. And so my next book basically takes the hero's journey and applies it to life, both in terms of personal development as sort of like a thesis for self-directed growth, but also as a tool set for problem solving. You know, I think that if you look at the hero's journey and you're experiencing something difficult right now, you know, for some people, it's building a business. For some people, it's going through bankruptcy or a divorce. For some people, it's becoming a father or a mother or anything, or like jumping into this health transformation, right? You become, you know, you one day your doctor gives you this wake-up call and they say, you need to make this change or you're going to die. And that is what Campbell calls the call to adventure or the inciting event. And now at first you're resistant to that because you're like, it's too hard. And that's refusal of the call. That's stage two. And then eventually somebody comes along who makes you believe you can do that. Maybe you listen to Bulletproof Radio. Maybe you pick up Engineering the Alpha. Maybe you find one of our websites. Maybe it's Dr. Oz. Maybe it's Tim Ferriss. Maybe it's yeah. Rob Wolf or Mark Sisson, whomever. There's this character that appears in every great story. And whether it's Obi-Wan or Mr. Miyagi or Morpheus in the Matrix, there's this mentor figure, and that is the person that you learn from as you begin to go through this journey. And then it just goes on from there, the crossing the first threshold to, you know, the ordeal, all the way to the master of two worlds and return with the elixir. And I think that, excuse me, and I think that every major endeavor in your life, and many of the smaller ones, again, marriage, divorce, writing a book, starting a business, they all follow this step-by-step plan of the hero's journey. So highly recommend that everyone read The Hero with a Thousand Faces, but I will mention it is a little dry and it's very cumbersome in that Campbell makes most of his points through analogy and comparison. And in order to really like get that, it's better to have a strong basis in mythology, which most of us don't. So for the time being, the book that I would recommend is one called The Writer's Journey by Christopher Vogler. And this is a great introduction to Campbell. And Vogler makes these same points using comparison and analogy, but rather than using these myths that you've never heard of, he uses movies and TV shows that you have heard of and books that you're more likely to have heard of. And it's like everything from The Lion King to Beverly Hills Cop to the Romancing the Stone to Zoolander and things that are just a little bit more pop culture oriented and more part of the zeitgeist to which you are probably accustomed. So you don't have to like go and, you know, like try and figure out which version of, you know, the Red Knight to read and which one's been, you know, has like all the shit that's been expurgated and versus. So just Vogler's work is really, really fantastic. My goal for my book is twofold. First, I think it will help a lot of people, but my big, hairy, audacious goal, as we say in the marketing world, is I would like my book on the hero's journey to be the book that Campbell scholars and Campbell devotees recommend to people who have never read Campbell. You know, in much the same way that I say, hey, you should read Vogler before you read Campbell, it'll help. My goal is 5 years from now, people who love Campbell will be like, oh, you should read Romanello, and that'll be a good entry point to Campbell, and then you could read Campbell. So it's really, like, it's a big goal.
What an awesome goal, though, and very clearly, like, very clearly delineated. I love that. And I also, John, I appreciate just having had a chance to, you know, ride on a bus with you at Mastermind Talks with Jason Gaynard. Just to sit and chat, you think about a lot of stuff, and you're totally willing to go there on the personal development front. And there's always been sort of a perspective that like that's not masculine to do it. And you're definitely a masculine guy, and you're totally like, no, I'm gonna own this. I'm just gonna look at it, and it's just part of the whole equation. Ferriss is similar, and there's just a lot of people. Maybe it's because I'm old, you know, at 43, but you know, my generation, we didn't do it that way. But the shift is really cool because if you get your testosterone up and you're feeling really good and you're still anxious and unhappy and you haven't done that level of work, you're still going to act like a jerk all the time, right?
I feel very fortunate to be part of the generation to which I belong in that, I think there's a lot of negative talk around like millennials, and I'm like right on the cusp of pre-millennial. But I will say this for millennials is like they're generally like working really hard to establish equality, and I think that it's really interesting. You know, I was raised by women, and so I have a really strong feminist bent, and I have been very, very fortunate in my male friendships that I have never been made to feel weird for feeling very, very strongly or projecting very vocally in terms of women's rights or rights for the LGBTQ community. And this is stuff that I feel very passionate about. Like I'm aware that as a, you know, as like a white male, I'm like, I don't really have a lot of problems. Like I've never had an issue getting pulled over. Yeah. And I really am very dedicated to using the platform that I built to helping people. And to that end, I'm running an event in Austin, Texas, September 16th to 18th with a friend of mine named David Delanave called Man Camp. And, you know, we are going to like have more traditionally, like we're going to eat steak and shoot guns and, nice. And talk about sex, but it's also, you know, we're going to have like deep, deep conversations about what it means to be a man in sort of the current, in the modern world, in the current environment, and how we can be masculine while at the same time promoting feminism. And I'm really excited about it. I think that these are deep conversations worth having. So
are you sold out on that event? Do you want to drop a URL for people?
It's austinmancamp.com. I think we have like 6 spots left, but if anyone is interested in coming, we'd love to have you. It's going to be great.
And that is right before the Bulletproof Conference, September 23rd. So
is that also in Austin?
No, that's in Pasadena.
Okay, that's right. I knew that.
But I was just thinking, I don't know if it'll be helpful. You may sell the spots out already, but I'm willing to knock 50% off the Bulletproof Conference rate for anyone who goes to Man Camp.
Well, I am willing to knock 50% off from Man Camp for anyone who's coming in through Bulletproof. Just let us know when you're at the URL, and we will give you 50% off. And if you go to both, you say it's like going to 2 events for the price of 1. I'd be happy to do it.
Oh, so beautiful, awesome!
7 spots left, and David, I know that you're going to be busy planning your event, but if you can make it to Austin, we'd love to have you.
I would absolutely love to be there. Maybe next year. This year, I don't think I'm going to make it, but I appreciate the invitation. It would be great fun.
Awesome, John. All right, well, thank you for your time, man. I really appreciate you having me on, and let me just chat with you. It means a lot.
Great, great fun. See you soon.
Talk soon, dude. Bye bye.
Thanks for watching. Get tons more original info to make it easier to kick more ass at life when you sign up with a free newsletter at bulletproofexec.com and stay bulletproof.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.